This is the son of PCJ.
Hopefully so, because you know I might be something of a sexagenarian now myself. Yeah, forget about the prefix, but sexagenarian myself. Can you believe it? I mean, gee, my gosh, where have all those years gone? I mean, we all end up saying that, but you know, I feel more alive and younger than I've ever felt, possibly.
Maybe some of you have lived through or with, at some stage of your life, that sound, the sound of an erupting volcano. In Italy, Mount Etna appears to be building up a head of steam again, belching black smoke into the air and rumbling like a subway tunnel. The last eruption of Mount Etna was in March last year, and experts say it's still too early to determine whether she'll blow it up again. A report from Winston Lawton.
I'm standing where others lie. Many thousands of young men, many younger than myself when they fell, in what they said would be the war to end all wars. I'm standing in Flanders Fields.
I've got another work by Brahms to play too in the program. Not exactly light classical music, but a magnificent piece of oratorio that somewhere in the course of the program I'll find a suitable place to slot in. It just seems, though, that somehow, today, there's a definite tendency in my selection towards the waltz, the march, and the dance.
The most treasured memories of my life, in fact, were the years that I spent in London and being exposed to, of course, you know, the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, and indeed I had interviews and even met up with, at one time, right here, isn't it amazing, in Taiwan, with one of the big names, in fact, in the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Media Network Plus. As you probably gather, the opening to this week's show is very different. We also won't be bringing you this week's headlines from the world of media or our propagation forecast. The voice you heard at the beginning of the program was that of David Monson. Who is David Monson? Many of you will remember that name as he was the host for many years of Brussels Calling on the external service of Belgian radio. Last week, just as Paulette and myself were finishing the recording of last week's show, I received an email from Dante, David Monson's son. He wrote, I noticed your mention of some Brussels Calling recordings at the Media Network blog. I also noticed you lived in Taipei, which is where my father lived for a number of years. My father suddenly passed away while cycling with friends in the German countryside last March, almost 1 year ago. To say I was shocked was an understatement. David was a very special person, witty, intelligent, and very passionate. Now, many of you are thinking, how could you find out a year later that he passed away? Were you not concerned if he didn't respond to an email? Well, something that was a little funny about David is you could send him an email and not get a response. And then maybe 6 or 8 months later, after you forgot that you sent it, he would reply. On today's edition of Media Network Plus, we're going to be remembering David Monson. Our guests on the program today are Jeff White of WRMI in the United States and Bob Zanotti, formerly of Swiss Radio International. Jeff, let me begin with you because David gave me some tapes of a program that he did in South Africa called the Tuesday at 8. And one of them contains you calling in from Chicago doing a report about a snowstorm. How did you meet David? Because David was in South Africa at the time. You were in the United States. How did you meet him? Did he just call you up out of the blue and say, yes, yes, you've got to come on the show. Talk about the snowstorm.
I really don't remember how I first met him, except that I think I probably... You know, I mean, I was a shortwave listener, and I probably heard his program, Brussels Calling. Now, we did, and Bob knows this, David was a partner in an enterprise that we had called Radio Earth that I was also involved in. And I remember when I was in Curacao producing this, it was a daily one-hour program, David was doing commentaries from Belgium at the time, and he happened to find a payphone in Brussels that would make international calls without needing money. And so he would just call us up in Curacao every day and feed the commentary. But I also had traveled to Europe a few times and worked with David on planning some various projects, and we went to some EDXC, European DX Council conferences together as well.
Bob, let's get to you. Your connection with David Monson, how did you meet him?
A very similar answer to that our good friend Jeff just said. I'm not completely sure anymore, but I know it had something to do, pardon me, with a European DX Council meeting. And I don't keep book on it, but if my recollection is correct, it would be the late 70s when we actually were in Brussels. And I think David showed up at that particular time. And then there was another occasion, which is almost legendary. Ian McFarlane will remember this because Ian and I did joint reports about it. RCI and SRI, the two communications programs, worked together very often. And that was in Berlin in the spring of 1989, actually just a few months before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And that was the occasion when David initiated the idea for International Radio Days, he called it. And this was meant to be a big meeting of major shortwave broadcasters to meet with the public and to try to explain and bring their message of international broadcasting to the public. And that brought us to Berlin, and that was the second meeting. On a very official and professional level, professionally, I never had that much to do with David. My contacts with him were mainly later on when he came to visit us here in the Emmental. He would call suddenly out of nowhere. You'd get a call from David saying, I'm in Europe, but I'll save those details for you later.
My meeting, David, of course, was thanks to the two of you. And even though I didn't know him as long as the two of you, he was, as far as I'm concerned, and I think he would be flattered if I said this, but I mean, there's no doubt about it, David was eccentric. David was very eccentric. And I recall a time in 2010 when I did a sit-down interview with him that was probably the most extraordinary interview that I've ever done with anyone because it ran nearly 2 hours. And when I was editing the interview, I constantly had to edit out my voice saying, okay, David, good topic, but let's get back on to my original question. He'd start answering it and then go off in a completely different direction. And then I'd always have to like, okay, David, let's get back to the original question again.
That was typical, Keith. I think we all had that experience with him. Some people would call him or might have called him scatterbrained, and you mentioned eccentric. But you know, it's interesting. We all knew him, and I knew him fairly well because I can go into details later if you wish. He was here, and we had some really quiet, deep moments in long, late-night discussions. And this word eccentric, there's nothing wrong with that. But you know, in technical terms, in physics, anything which is eccentric is sort of out of the box. It's not in conformity, I should say, with the norm or the standard. Now, if you look at it one way, that could be an apt definition of creativity. And David was extremely creative, and it manifested as what people might call eccentric. Also, this notion of being a bit scatterbrained in his thoughts all over the page and so on. And this, of course, can also be the mark of a highly creative individual. The problem there is that he was not able to focus his thoughts, as you've said. I mean, he'd have, I guess they call it stream of consciousness in psychology. Anything that popped into his head, it simply grabbed him and he went off in that tangents all over the place. But his mind was never quiet. His mind was always working. I don't know if he ever really slept or rested. He was just a bundle of energy. I mean, a volcano of energy. And everything was in his mind. Everything was in his mind. His mind was never quiet. That's one way I would characterize David Monson.
You see, he was always, his mind was always going in various different directions at the same time. And it was always ahead of his, you know, of his body, although he physically moved fast as well. And so he'd start out, he'd be doing a live, you know, commentary on the radio, and he'd start out talking about, you know, some aspect of architecture in Belgium, and he'd end up talking about eating 10 hamburgers at McDonald's or something. And it was, but I mean, it was very interesting. And it was, and he had a hard time. You know, from what Bob said is correct. He was very, very creative and had a hard time accepting the concept of a dry script for a radio program. So what he would do, he was required to do that at Brussels Calling, but he would often record the program, you know, based on the official script in the daytime. And then after the editors went home in the evening, he would go back and go into the studio, and he had a good relationship with the studio operators, and he would go on live and do the program live, a totally different program from what had been pre-recorded with the script. But it was, and it was stream of consciousness programming, exactly. But you know, people liked that, in particularly in North America and somewhat in Europe. I think it was very different from what was on most state-owned shortwave stations at the time.
It's amazing, you know, what I can see from my window, from our studio window. I'd feel rather like Bartleby in Herman Melville's short story. You remember him staring out at a blank wall? Well, I'd feel rather like Bartleby if it wasn't for the fact that the wall on the opposite side of my studio happens to contain floor upon floor. There are 11 of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1911, yes. Floor upon directors on the 10th or 11th floor, not quite sure. Perhaps he spends his life gazing down in my window. Now, floor upon floor of those asymmetrical windows. Now, it's not the asymmetry of the windows that interests me. It's the goings-on behind the windows that does, and I'm not sure sometimes whether the occupants of the offices they give light to realize that somewhere on the opposite side of the building, the eyes of a voyeur are at work, a peeping Tom at his dirty work. This could also end up sounding like the first chapter of a novel by a French existentialist. Ever heard of Babousse? I was always fascinated by that first chapter of L'Enfer, that's what it is, right? Hell, where the principal character is found almost on the first page, I think, peeping through a hole in the wall, or was it a keyhole? And he was peeping through the hole at his neighbors in the hotel room next door. If you want to know what they were up to, well, read the book. What's so wrong with wanting to know what the neighbors are doing, anyhow? Everybody wants to know what I'm doing. I mean, my neighbors, that is, my street. I'm treading on dangerous ground now, but I'm almost sure that... Oh, would you believe it? There they go again. Barbusse's hero. Almost sure that Barbusse's hero or anti-hero would have found as much delight in his unnatural pastime by working for the radio station, this radio station. Now, this has left your guessing, I suppose. I'm sure you'd give anything to find out what was actually going on right now in our studio. You can only hear my voice, and I'll vouchsafe for the fact that I'm proper enough, but you should see how the rest of them carry on here when I'm on the air. Sodom and Gomorrah had nothing on our studios. You can believe me if you wish. To get back to the window. And by the way, this is the first chapter of an existential novel I'm writing. Getting back to the windows, then, and what I can see in the windows opposite our studio. Right at this moment of time, what looks like a young blonde combing her long blonde hair, her one or two long blonde hairs. In a moment she'll be laying on the lipstick. Yes, that's exactly what I thought. Yes, a touch of rouge to the right and the left cheek,
dab of powder to the brow. Quick squirt of whatever deodorant to below the right and left ear. She stands back to admire her handiwork, deodorant to the right or left ear, under her arm. She stands back to admire handwork, her handiwork. She gives herself a kiss in the mirror and gets lost once again in her handbag, no doubt searching for the nail polish. I wonder what director she's going out with tonight.
Jeff, that leads me to the question, because in the 1980s, there was an album, vinyl, a disc that was released of some of the best excerpts from Brussels Calling. You were involved in that project. How did that manifest?
Well, David had the idea. I think it was, I'm not sure if he was still at Belgian Radio Television at the time or not, but he had those tapes of some of the mailbag programs and what he called his mobile monologues, which were these sort of stream-of-consciousness programs. And he picked out some of the best of them and talked about, you know, he said, do you think it would be a good idea to do an LP of these, and then we could give the profits to the Handicapped Aid Program in North America? And so Ian McFarlane became involved in this also. He was head of the Handicapped Aid Program in Canada. And so, I don't know, David ended up making arrangements with a studio in Nashville, Tennessee, which produces most of the records here in the U.S., I think. And I handled some of the distribution and organizational matters on that. But it was Mail and Mobile Monologues was the title of the LP.
You know, I've listened to it, and something that you mentioned a moment ago, it was very different from what most, let's say, state publicly funded international broadcasters were doing at the time. And you listen to it, and you kind of wonder, because in many ways, these, when David was at Belgian Radio doing Brussels Calling, it really brought, I would suspect, a lot more listeners, a lot of people thinking, oh, this is like a breath of fresh air. And the odd thing is that he never really had support from Belgian Radio doing this.
He did have a kind of a constant love and hate relationship with the BRT. And eventually, you know, he left because I don't think he could handle the situation there. I mean, like I said, he found ways of getting around the bureaucracy there by doing things his own way, such as going back in at night and doing the programs live. But, you know, they had lists up, for example, of how many times an announcer would mention a product name or say God bless at the end of a program or something like that, and things that David would do, and they put them up on the wall, you know, to sort of make people look bad. And, you know, he didn't, you know, this wasn't the sort of thing that he liked, of course, but he grinned and buried it for many years before he left.
Well, this issue of his relationship, not only to Belgian radio, but also to Belgium, it was, I have to be careful here, but I don't know, we had hours of late night discussion, and he gave me the clear impression that he really wasn't happy in Belgium at all. In fact, he used a couple of expressions we can't use here on the air. But no, he wasn't terribly happy. I think, though, in all fairness, he was one of these wandering souls who probably was never happy anywhere. In fact, I'll confess, I'm a little bit like that. It just has to do with my being a Sagittarian or something, whatever that is. I've been told that anyway by the experts. And in David's case, he was definitely a citizen of the world, and he was very deep and very intelligent. And he also was very critical. He was not politically correct. I'm not either, but he certainly wasn't. And I think his attitude towards the radio station there was, don't get me wrong, I don't take me literally, but in a way it was almost devil may care, almost a suicidal attitude. He was not a corporate politician. I think he somehow, this is speculation, but I always had the feeling he regarded the radio station up there in Brussels as somehow his own personal radio station. And he was going to push the envelope, as people say today, and see how far he could get away with it. Or he just never thought about it or never cared. There are some people like this who are, you know, we know them in corporations, in business. There are these people who we call them organizational politicians. You know, there are other expressions which are less flattering. David was anything but that. He was a seeker of the truth. He explained things or commented on things as a social critic and observer the way he felt it, the way he saw it. And I don't think the term censorship and certainly self-censorship would ever have occurred to him. And to be honest, I was surprised sometimes that he got away with what he did. Certainly, you couldn't have done that kind of thing on a station like Swiss Radio International or most other stations I can think of, certainly not Radio Canada International. And yet, he in a way, he pushed the envelope to extremes, and he got away with it for quite some time. But I think he was using it was a kind of ventilation. The internet today, I mean, he could have his own radio station. In those days, you couldn't. I think today he would be a great success on the internet, and he'd be very happy doing that. But in those days, you only had one outlet to the world, and that was shortwave. And I think that's the medium he was using to try to address people and talk to the world about his ideas and how he saw the world.
I would venture to say that, you know, in a way, BRT and Brussels Calling was perhaps even more effective in presenting Belgium to the world because of David's format, or lack of format, if you will. I mean, he was a wealth of knowledge about things like classical music and the history of Belgium. And I mean, he loved Europe and this sort of thing. And he could talk about it. He could talk about it in a personal way, which was very different, you know, from these scripts that were prepared by most stations. And I think in many ways the program was more effective and perhaps a better way of presenting Belgium than the traditional way.
Hello, hello, France.
Hello, David.
Hello, Paul. Okay, you can hear me down there, can
you? Yes, we can hear you.
On the Kurmacht. All right.
Okay.
Up here, that's me, yours truly, David Monson, on the tower of the Gravenstein. My gosh, if I have to climb another step today, or for that matter, climb down another step, I shall die on the spot, I swear. Anyhow, there's our technicians down there in the mobile studio on the Kurmacht, and they've done a remarkable job of work. I can assure you, if they don't get a gold medal after all this, after their efforts over the past couple of days, well, we'll certainly make sure that you get the freedom of this city. I've spoken to the mayor about that, Paul, in France. And
before we end off, I want to ask each of you to share some anecdote about David that you will certainly never forget. Who's going to go first?
Oh, well, I remember the very first time that I went to Europe. It was in 1981. And I was actually going, remember, Bob, you all sponsored the European DX Council conference there in Bern.
And that's right.
I was going to that, but I flew into Luxembourg on Iceland there, and I was going to stay for a few days in with David in Brussels. And he picked me up. He said he was going to pick me up at the airport in Luxembourg. I got to the airport, and I was waiting in the customs and immigration lines, and they called my name on the loudspeaker. And so I got out of line. I went to an Icelandair representative, and I said they called my name on the PA. And they said, yes, you have a message from Mr. David Monson. He says he is going to be delayed, but he will be there to pick you up, so wait for him. So I did. And sure enough, in a little bit, David arrived, and we were putting my luggage into his Mazda RX-7. And he explained that he was delayed because he had been in Brussels, and in a parking space, he backed into a car belonging to one of the African ambassadors to Belgium, and so he was tied up with the paperwork and the police reports and so on. So he was late picking me up, and then he said, the problem is I have to get back to Brussels in time to do Brussels Calling Live. So we raced back to Brussels from Luxembourg at about 160, 180 kilometers an hour, weaving in and out of traffic. I mean, David was like, you know, a race car driver. And we got into Brussels, whipped into the underground parking garage at the BRT building, ran up a few flights of stairs, dashed into the studio, and, I mean, he had it timed perfectly. The pre-recorded newscast was just ending, And he went into the studio, sat down, they turned his microphone on, he motioned for me to come into the studio, and he said, welcome to Brussels Calling here on Belgian Radio and Television. I'm David Monson, and I have a guest with me here tonight. Jeff White has just arrived from the United States. Jeff, what do you think of Belgium? And this is the first time I'd ever been to Europe, first time I'd ever been to Belgium, and I'd only been there for, you know, an hour or two. And I didn't know whether it was a joke or whether he was serious, and so I just said, well, David, it's kind of hard to see Belgium at 200 kilometers an hour. So, but this is the kind of programs he did, you know?
Well, I don't have anything that will top that, Jeff, but I have a couple of maybe contrasting recollections or maybe things you'll remember, too. I remember at one affair, David had... I think he was going to entertain us with a piano recital. He was quite an accomplished pianist, also Dante, his son, which is one of the reasons that David wanted to move to Germany so he could have better musical education. And, you know, he put on a recital of, I think, Beethoven or something, you know, very staid and very standard. And then all of a sudden, I said, I will now improvise. Well, he went on... For me, it was a cacophony, and it was the oral version, the acoustic version of David's mind. It was all over the place. I mean, he literally, to try to give a vivid picture, he probably would be anybody's classic vision of the mad musician. His long hair flying, his head twisting and back and forth and jerking and... all kinds of movements, and it was just, I mean, I wish somebody had recorded it. It was the acoustic rendition of David Monson's mind.
Jeff White, Bob Zanotti, thank you very much for joining us today on this program looking at David Monson, who we just discovered passed away March 2011, and we only found out about it last week, but as I mentioned earlier, if you didn't get a reply from an email that you sent, it wasn't unusual. Jeff White, Bob Zanotti, thank you very much.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you, Keith. It's been fun thinking and remembering back to some of the good times with David Monson. He'll surely be missed.
And with that, we conclude this edition of Media Network Plus, looking back at David Monson, who passed away in March 2011. If you wish to contact us, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, including Jeff White and Bob Zanotti, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, and we'll see you again very soon. 73s to you all, and 88s to the ladies.